What's the sound of a generation? Every generation has its soundtrack, songs that change and define the way music sounds. But what's the sound of the Generation Y, those born in the early 80s through the early 90s? To help figure it out, I have some help. Carrie Brownstein, a great writer for an NPR blog called Monitor Mix. She also played guitar in a band called Slater Kenny. Carrie's at Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland. Amy Phillips, Amy's a senior news editor for Pitchfork Media. She's at WBEZ in Chicago. Pitchfork Media, of course, is a terrific source of music and music news for many of those millennials or Generation Y people. And sitting alongside of me, making faces in Washington, D.C., is NPR Music Song of the Day editor Stephen Thompson.
There's a destination a little up the road from the habitations of the towns we know. A place we saw the lights turn low, the jigsaw jazz and the get fresh flow. Pulling out jobs and jamboree handouts, two turntables and a microphone. Bottles and cans, or just clap your hands, or just clap your hands.
Where's that?
So, we're listening to Beck, and I wanted to start off by talking about music of other generations. And let's figure this out. Stephen Thompson and Carrie Brownstein, you're both Generation
X.
Is that true of Carrie?
I'm 35.
Yeah.
I'm 33.
So
yes.
Just this very topic, just the fact that we're having this conversation makes me feel 1,000 years old. And, what are the young people listening to?
And Amy's closer to that. you would be closer to a Generation Y. What
I suppose. I am 26, born in 1981.
And I was born a lot earlier than all of you.
How much older, Bob?
Twice Amy's age. So let's figure out what it is that defines a generation. Let's talk about Generation X for a minute. And Stephen Thompson, what do you think of when you think of Generation X and the music that defined it?
You know, it's always tricky to sum up any sort of generational movement. I mean, there are always, I guess we should have the caveat up front that there are 9 trillion exceptions to every rule that we're talking about here. But I think that there's a certain amount of defiance, a certain amount of feeling a little bit left out. And I think a lot of the music has, at least a lot of the important music, has a lot of the feel of trying to make the listener seem bigger. You know, I was pulling out what I would consider the iconic music of my generation, and I was pulling out a lot of Public Enemy and pulling out a lot of Nirvana and a lot of these bands. And a lot of it, there's just this bigness to it. The listener feels sort of like he or she's been given short shrift. And the music kind of is trying to give this voice to the voiceless. And there's a little Rage Against the Machine, you know, is another example where there's a little bit of an element of stridency to it, and also just a little bit of you're small, now feel big.
Does that make sense to you, Carrie? Do you feel that?
Yeah, I think it was a lot of music that embodied a validation, you know, a lot of self-affirmation and just acknowledgement. I think, you know, if you're born in the 70s and you grew up with the music of your parents' generation, and these were bands that supposedly, you know, pioneered huge social movements or were the soundtrack to these movements, and then all of a sudden you're in the 80s and you feel, unless you're listening to hardcore at that time, which, you know, I was only 12, so I can't really say that I was, you know, you're listening to all this pop music and you think, well, you know, how am I supposed to relate to this music, and how have we made it to a point of meaninglessness? And so I think a lot of this music in the early 90s and what Stephen's talking about is all of a sudden this huge stamp of validation of finding out who you are and realizing that, you know, kind of acknowledging an anger or an angst.
We should pick a piece of music that, let's say, for Carrie, made you think for the first time that you sort of own this music, that this was something of your generation that couldn't have been anybody else's.
I mean, I have to go with the most obvious, which is Nirvana.
Okay. Me too.
and let's play, and then we'll come back, pick a song, we'll come back and we'll talk about what it was and maybe even remembering when you heard it.
We'll go with, I guess we can go with Lithium.
I'm so happy, 'cause today found my in our days, 'cause I found God.
Steven, get off the table. He never behaves. Do you remember first hearing the song, Carrie?
Oh, certainly. I grew up in Seattle, so Nirvana was a band that I had seen before they became huge. But at the same time, I had no idea that they were going to be as big and powerful and meaningful as they became. And the station in Seattle, the alternative rock station, The End, 107.7, played Smells Like Teen Spirit. I was on my way to school my senior year. They played that song. This is a mainstream radio station, ad infinitum. I don't know when they started playing it or when they stopped playing it because I had to get to school, but I cannot think of another moment in history, in my own personal history, where there was a major radio station that just played a song over and over again. It was like a dam had burst open. And it was a huge moment, and it brought together so many disparate people. I mean, everything before then was in little factions. You had the underachieving college rock genre. You had the remnants of hardcore. You had people that were still listening to pop music and country music. And all of a sudden, pretty much everyone was listening to and starting to the same thing and starting to dress the same way and starting to acknowledge that we felt disaffected. Well, I mean, I just think there's no other band like Nirvana. Our generation, it would be so hard to pick anyone else.
Well, and you're talking about those factions. I mean, I grew up in very small town central Wisconsin. And even though I was in college by the time that that particular Nirvana record came out, I can tell you it affected the hair metal kids, and it affected the shop kids, and it affected sort of everybody.
How did it affect?
I mean, it affected them in that it sort of blew away everything that they were listening to and everything I was listening to. Talking about these larger generational issues and sort of getting back to what sort of, I guess, for lack of a better term, what defines Generation X, I think if you look back, a lot of it was sort of the sense that we were going to be the first generation that wasn't going to be as well off as our parents. You know, that was sort of a big, like, sort of larger issue that everybody was talking about at that time, was like, you know, we're kind of, you know, and that whole thing about being sort of disaffected and disappointed. You know, Nirvana, I think, definitely, and that sound, you know, sort of taps into that, not to get too fussy and analytical about it.
Amy, what year would you have come to Nirvana?
I first heard Nirvana when I was 12.
And
that's a very, very good time to first hear Nirvana, I would say, because you're still kind of forming who you are. And hearing Nirvana certainly helped form me into the person that I am today, introduced me to this whole new world of possibility of underground rock and rock nerdery. And I haven't returned since going down that road.
Let's go with another one, Stephen, from that time period. You think of Nirvana.
Yeah, I'm going to sort of continue on the path of talking about music to make people feel big, and pick Public Enemy, which I think had that sort of, you know, a few years earlier, but sort of having that same feel of you know, you're anybody who feels sort of disaffected and downtrodden is going to be made to feel bigger by the sound of this music. And I think to go with that, let's play Fight the Power.
Yet our best trained, best educated, best equipped, best prepared troops refuse to fight. Matter of fact, it's safe to say that they would rather switch than fight.
Your heart, 'cause I know you got soul. Nothing is this pain.
Hey. Listen if you miss.
dancing, y'all, swinging while I'm singing.
Hey!
Giving what you're getting, knowing what I'm knowing, while the black band's sweating in the rhythm I'm rolling.
Rolling.
Gotta give us what we want. Gotta give us what we need.
Hey!
Our freedom of speech is freedom of death.
We got to fight the powers that be.
Fight the power.
Where did you first hear? Did you? Is this a radio thing?
I heard this at, in the credits to Do the Right Thing.
Ah.
So.
And I'm thinking about the idea of collective consciousness in culture for the boomer generation, for your generation. You all sort of heard stuff coming at you at the same time, be it radio or movies.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I mean, Public Enemy sort of is a classic thing to hear when you're, you know, when you're kind of coming into your freshman year of college, growing up in a very, very small town. Just this sense that there are all these perspectives that are new to you, and there's all this, you know, that's a great soundtrack to sort of budding social awareness that comes with, you know, moving out of your parents' house and starting to learn things that are bigger than you.
I'm going to save the current generation a little bit to the later part of this conversation, but is that just true of rock and roll in general? I mean, would you say that is true of the budding freshman going to college now?
Yeah, I like to think that everybody hits a point at a... I think anything you're listening to at the point in your life when you're coming of age is going to have an iconic quality to it, because that's what you were listening to when all these things happened to you in your life. And you know, I'm fortunate in that maybe this is true of everybody. Everybody feels this way. I'm fortunate in that it happened to happen during some great music.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're going to make iconic whatever is happening to you during those incredibly important times in your life.
The number one song in 1990 was "How Am I Supposed to Live Without You" by Michael Bolton.
Well, that song also was very important.
yeah, number two would be Paula Abdul, "Opposites Attract."
Oh, yeah.
Escapade by Janis Jackson.
That was huge for me. I was a big MC Scat Cat fan. So.
what I'm trying to figure out, and we may do this with the Boomer generation. I have a bunch of charts in front of me because it's kind of fun to look at. Is the music that is the music that sells, the music that's popular, the music that hits Billboard magazine, and the music that defines a generation, what's the connection or what's the disconnection? Amy, do you see anything in the music that people buy lots of, and then when you look back at what defined the generation, is that the music that defines it?
Well, it doesn't. It doesn't. I think especially now that is certainly changing, when nobody has to buy a song for it to be immensely popular. I think that it is certainly more than just sales. It's what's in the kind of in the cultural air. It's in the movies. It's referenced in, you know, jokes on TV shows, that, you know, in the slang. It's the way that songs and artists get integrated into our daily lives that makes something lasting and popular, and, you know, the quote sound of a generation. You know, yeah, everyone listened to Michael Bolton, but we didn't really, you know, talk a lot about Michael Bolton, or maybe some people did, but it didn't seem like, you know, we didn't get catchphrases from Michael Bolton. We didn't maybe, you know, Michael Bolton showed up in Office Space as a punchline of a joke.
Sure.
But things like Public Enemy, you know, kind of changed the cultural currents in ways.
Yeah, I mean, you could also say that some of what we reacted to as kids, I mean, Michael Bolton is one thing, but New Kids on the Block, you know, were absolutely a part of the cultural dialogue for kids, you know, growing up in the late 80s.
Sure.
I'm looking at the charts for, I just love this, I'm sorry. This is Geekland here. I'm looking at the charts for 1970. Seven, another generation here. Hotel California by the Eagles, Wings Over America, A Star Is Born, Barbra Streisand, Rumors, Fleetwood Mac, Barry Manilow Live, and Linda Ronstadt, Simple Dreams. And if there was any case for the reason that punk music came to life, that would be six of them. Talent aside, you know, these folks might have been talented.
And who's on the cover of Rolling Stone right this minute? The Eagles.
Wow.
Wow.
Unrecognizably, I might add.
So can I just
saw that cover.
Can I just clean my palate a little bit and listen to a song? It's called 16. It's by the Buzzcocks, and we'll come back and talk.
Swallow my tongue, and you think that you're old, so very old. You only want me because you think I'm so young. Young, 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 young. All right, okay, no way.
And I felt the same way that you might have felt when listening to Nirvana, Public Enemy, when those just horrible records, those bits of poison,
a winger,
came onto the radio, and hearing the breath of fresh air of a group doing such simple stuff as the Buzzcocks did, making 2.5 minute great pop songs. Look, let me just say a couple of things. One is that we're going to try to move through a lot of material. We're going to leave a lot out. We're trying to get sort of broad ideas and points. There's a whole bunch of blog postings about this, really bright writing that people have put on the All Songs Considered blog. Go there, add to it, and you'll see some really insightful stuff. And full versions of these songs that we're playing here will also be on the website. But one thing that Stephen and I had talked about during the course of the week and thinking about this show is how sometimes a kind of music happens and it doesn't get into those top-selling charts, but it morphs itself later and pops up in ways. We looked at a DC 101 chart, which is a radio chart for a station here in Washington, D.C.
A local rock station in D.C.
And you see how some of the grunge, some of the, you know,
yeah, you see sort of like Stone Temple Pilots was in their top 20, and a Puddle of Mud. And going back to feeling 1,000 years old, you know, doing this like anthropological dig through current radio charts felt sort of silly. But yeah, it was sort of fascinating the way, I mean, and, you know, you can talk about this with virtually any genre there is, where you feed, you know, you sort of start out with something really pure and interesting, and you kind of feed it into this giant machine, and it gets digested. And 10 years later, it's still on the radio as something far, you know, far, far different.
Well, the Eagles is a prime example for me of that, because, you know, a band I just can't listen to. I think of other words. But at their heart was the fact that rock music could do sort of a country-flavored thing and have nice harmonies, and there's nothing wrong with any of that. But you think back not very far long before that and take a band like The Byrds and something like Sweetheart of the Rodeo, which is a completely revolutionary album for rock music back then, because this might be hard to describe, but in some ways, with the hippies, country music was thought of a very redneck thing, and politically polar opposite. And so for rock music to sort of embrace country music was really strange. And Gram Parsons and what the Byrds did on Sweetheart of the Rodeo is a good example. And it would morph into the Eagles later. but let's give a listen to something a little more pure from 1969, cut from Sweetheart of the Rodeo. What did I pick? You Ain't Going Nowhere, I think.
So swift, rain won't lift, gate won't close, railings froze. Get your mind off winter time, you ain't going nowhere. The morning came, the morning went.
pack up your money, pick up your tent. You ain't going nowhere.
Amy Phillips, do you have a perception of, we'll talk about the boomer generation for a little bit, about, well, how would you define it in either song or description?
The boomer generation?
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's, for people my age, it's your parents. I guess for some kids younger than me, your grandparents even.
Rob just looked so defeated.
I remember I'm at the, you know, high end of Generation Y, I guess, you know, 1981, you know. If you talk to someone born in 1995 or 6, you know, they would probably...
But the perception of the music really is what I'm
music,
getting at.
Well, I think that, you know, a lot of members of my generation have kind of drank the Kool-Aid that this was the greatest music of all time, and nothing could ever have been better than it was in the 60s. Wow. And we, you know, kind of idolized that time. I think that, you know, certain, you know, various cultural producers have kind of made people think that, you know, whether it's, you know, places like Rolling Stone or various movies, you know, painting the 60s as this great time. But, you know, then I'd say the other half thinks that the boomer generation was a big failure that left us with debt and wreaked environmental havoc and is currently running the world into the ground.
And
so
sticking,
I think there's, there's both.
Right. And sticking with music on the bad side of it, I hear the equation of the debt and the environmental mess,
right? What I'm going to say is that those two attitudes can be filtered into the music, whether it's, you know, extreme reverence for the 60s and that sound, and, you know, young kids out there who are either still really really into quote unquote classic rock or, you know, kind of hippie revival kind of things. You know, you could say this whole freak folk, quote unquote, movement is an extension of that.
Where do you fall?
Definitely in the latter camp. kind of more cynical side of it, and kind of a rejection of, there's certainly plenty of music from the 60s that I enjoy. I don't feel any kind of personal connection to it, and I'd much rather listen to things that kind of rub up against that kind of 60s idealism, the more, you know, punk-influenced kind of thing.
One of the things that classic rock has done for both good and bad is it's painted a picture of that generation by bubbling certain music to the top. And for the most part, that's not the way it happened. So classic rock is sort of this weird reinvention of what of the music of the time. And bothers me to no end, but on the other hand, it's, you know, good for people in my mind to hear early Byrds music if they play it, or Dylan, or to hear some good guitar by Jimi Hendrix. But the fact was that what was happening for me then was that every day or every week you'd hear something new and incredible. And I think one of the things that I hear now in this generation, and maybe we should go on talking about that, is some of the current generation, is that I hear a lot of fresh music all the time, that there seems to be surprises to no end in the years from, you know, 2001 or so to now, more so than there was for me as a listener in the 90s even.
Well, the fact remains that there's more music being made now, or more music not necessarily being made, but being released now than ever before. I know Robert Christgau always cites some statistic about the number of albums being released goes up every year.
Oh, it's remarkable.
Just because of, you know, the the ways that technology has made it easier to produce, to make and produce music.
Well, and to distribute it.
And distribute it, yes, exactly. So there's just simply more music out there than there was then. You know, the law of averages, I guess, is in effect as well.
Well, and the ability of the audience to sample it and find out
how
much of it is out there has never, obviously, you know, for many obvious reasons, it's never been easier.
I don't think it's a numbers game myself. I think it's a regurgitation game in some ways. I mean, people hear so many things, and out of that comes new and exciting stuff.
I'm just curious if this question is even the question of what is the sound of a generation? Is that a generational question? I mean, is that a question that Generation Y is even concerned about?
I
feel like it's such a boomer or Generation X thing that this constant sort of meta discourse reflection to try to encapsulate, you know,
this
overriding theme.
I think
I'm just kind of curious.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. But I think as anyone grows up and you begin to look back, you know, maybe you're right. Maybe you won't if you're 19 years old and you won't look back. I can't imagine that. I can't imagine that because of what music does, because it's so indelible, it marks so much of your DNA that you will look back and think of the music of a time sounding like something.
Yeah, I can't imagine that this generation is less self-infatuated than the ones that came before it.
No, I think probably more so, but I'm just saying that it will be a different methodology, because it's a different, like we were talking about, the means of distribution. I mean, it seems a little more individualized.
Yeah.
You know, everyone's been waiting for that next Nirvana, you know, moment to happen, and it hasn't, because how could it? You know, so it seems like it will be a little more specific.
But the same thing happened with the Beatles. It was always through the 70s, where's the next Beatles? And it never happened. And so who is it? Radiohead? Who is the next? I mean, what would be this generation's biggest band? Start there. Is there such a thing?
I think Radiohead is a good example of the ways in which we can and can answer that question, in that they are the kind of band that seems to have bridged not only sales but kind of cultural dialogue. But at the same time, you know, they are never going to be as permeating the culture as much as Nirvana did at the time or the Beatles. So, you know, even when they pull off a stunt like, you know, putting out their record for free, et cetera, and they get, you know, editorials in the Los Angeles Times about them, and, you know, the entire music industry, you know, reconsiders itself, it's still not going to be as important, because, you know, music itself is less and less of a, has less and less of a monopoly on people's attention spans in general, which is depressing, I think. But
I agree, frankly.
but at the same time, people still love making lists and making big generalizations and saying these are the best records of the year, and, you know, I don't think that'll go away.
All right.
I was just going to add that Radiohead, I mean, I, you know, that they have bridged certain cultural gaps, but yet their fans, you know, are going to be of many generations. You know, they're not necessarily just speaking to the youth generation. So I don't. It's hard to even push them up as the main example. So it's a tough one. I couldn't name the biggest band for people that are 19 right now.
Well, I want to throw out one theory, and this is it's not entirely fully formed. So please forgive me. I do tend to do this sometimes. A lot of looking back when I was going through what are the defining bands of my generation, and I talked about this a little bit at the beginning, where there were a lot of bands that made, you know, that kind of were amplifiers in a way. They kind of took the emotions of its audience and of the players and kind of made them writ large, you know, you listen to it and you feel bigger. And I kind of feel like a lot of the defining music of this generation, and maybe it's a product of iPods or whatever, but I think a lot of the defining music of this generation kind of takes that and draws it back inward. That music in some ways, I don't want to say it makes people feel smaller exactly, but it's sort of a little bit more internal, a little bit more introspective. You know, when we talk about a lot of our favorite bands, a lot of the bands that have been played on this show, a lot of the bands that we celebrate, they're kind of, I mean, Radiohead is definitely this, like, you know, one man's tortured heart ripped out of his chest. It's a little bit more, I feel like it's a little bit more personal, a little bit more internal.
And I think some of the music that's made is that way because it is usually, often, a lot of the bands that we all tend to like and write about and think about are bands that are doing it in personal spaces, are doing it at home, doing it in friends' houses, friends' studios, doing it in an environment that's much more friendly. And I think that basically comes out with much more personal, sometimes quiet music. We obviously have completely ignored so far in this conversation hip-hop, for example.
I talked about Public Enemy.
Yeah, well, we did talk about Public Enemy. But in terms of this generation, we have in a blog post, a lot of people say that the defining sound of this generation is going to be hip-hop.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was last generation in many ways, but it still totally permeates this culture.
I think that you can reconcile both of those ideas, hip-hop and introspection. You know, the hip-hop that's popular and kind of important now isn't kind of Public Enemy strident, making
right.
you bigger. It's very, you know, individualistic, personal-based, whether that's talking about the problems in, you know, yourself or how great you are with women or cars or jewelry. You know, it's not, I know, once again, huge generalizations that, you know, I should be, you know, slapped for. But it is inward-looking, not world-changing, you know, lifting you up.
Yeah, I think there's less and less hip-hop that's sort of being shouted through a megaphone. You know, there's
right, or at least, you know, popular, you know.
Right.
Did you have something you wanted to play as an example of any of this, Amy?
The one hip-hop track that I thought was, you know, which is a good example of technological aspects of this, and a lot of these things I'm thinking about, was the Soulja Boy Crank That song, which, yes, a lot, you know, it's a funny song, it's a silly song, but, you know, it was made by one guy in his bedroom, uploaded onto YouTube, became a huge phenomenon, inspired a dance, then became a huge hit. Everybody does the dance. Everybody doing the dance goes on YouTube. Then everybody buys the song. It becomes number one for 7 weeks. It sells lots of ringtones. You listen to it on your phone. That's the means of production and distribution of music. You know, that's how you make a hit these days.
Good. Let's listen.
You! Soulja Boy, tough. Hey, I got this new dance for y'all called the Soulja Boy. You gotta punch, then crank back 3 times from left to right. Soulja Boy, I'm in it. Oh. Why me crank it? Why me roll? Why me crank that Soulja Boy? That Superman? That oh. Now why me crank that Soulja Boy? Now why me you crank that Soulja Boy? Now why me you crank that Soulja Boy? Now why me you crank that Soulja Boy? Now why Soulja Boy, I'm in it. Oh. Why me crank it? Why me roll? Why me crank that Soulja Boy? That Superman? That oh. Now why me you crank that Soulja Boy? Now why me you crank that Soulja Boy? Now why me you crank that Soulja Boy? Now why me you crank that song. Now what? Soulja Boy up in it. Oh. Why me lean that? Why me rock? Superman that. Oh. Yeah, why me crack that Robocop? Super friend, now why me jock? Jocking on them, hate them, man. When I do that Soulja Boy, I lean to the left, then crack that thing. Now you. I'm jocking on you. I'm jocking on you. And if we get the fight, then I'm counting on you. You catch me at your local party. Yes, I crack it every day. Haters getting mad because I got me some bathing, mate. Soulja Boy.
Now, I'm not sure how it's possible, Amy, that you can't think when you're 45, one day you'll be 45 years old, that you won't look back and think about all that you just said. The fact that you can have a song that turns into goes up online so a gazillion people see it, and they make their own videos and they do it. And I mean, that completely defines what this generation is. I mean, I think you sort of nailed it on your head in your description, but earlier in the conversation, maybe as we talked about this generation, we all sort of said, well, maybe they're not, people won't think so much about it. But it's so defining. It's so different.
And I think it has more to do, obviously, with the as somebody put it on the blog, it's about the access and it's about the means of getting the music rather than the product itself. I mean, I don't think it, when I'm 45, people are going to remember all the words to Crank That Soulja Boy, but they will remember, you know, how music was made and distributed.
And the technology is so often what drives the music. The technology, meaning the electric guitar and the wah-wah pedal for a generation I grew up in, and certainly the bad synthesizer sounds of the hair bands and maybe hair dryers, in fact, that made those hair bands. But certainly the technology drives pop music so much. Carrie, you have an interesting pick in MIA, which is something that takes it outside of just U.S. culture or British culture.
Right, and I think that is one thing that is more definitive of the access that we've been talking about, and having the means to get as much information as we can about any band, no matter, or any individual, no matter where they live in the world. It used to be so much more difficult to, you know, seek out music that had a broader influence or came from other locations. Now, MIA, I mean, she's mostly just British, but she is such a great embodiment of all, you know, culling so many different influences and combining that, and just the eclectic nature of her music. And also that, you know, in terms of the festivals that she plays, it used to be that, you know, something that drew from hip-hop influence or dance influence would be kind of on the periphery of the festival itself. But now I feel like it more defines kind of the nature of the music that people want to be listening to. They don't want it to be homogenous necessarily. And I think a lot of bands have followed in her footsteps in drawing from these broader influences. So I chose her as just somebody that I don't think would have had the same kind of popularity, you know, 5 or 10 years ago as she does now. And I think she has a really galvanizing figure in the sense that, you know, no matter what kind of music that you listen to or thought that you liked, you know, she's playing off all of those influences.
Good. Let's listen. What cut?
I think it's Bucky Dengun from her first album.
Great.
London, quieting down, I need to make a sound. New York, quieting down, I need to make a sound. Kingston, quieting down, I need to make a sound. Brazil, quieting down, I need to make a sound.
Stephen Thompson, you're going to take us somewhere completely different, same generation. Do it.
Well, you know, it's amazing that we've been talking for as long as we have about the sound of this generation and sort of the popular culture at large, and without mentioning American Idol. And I think that we were talking about the charts and sort of what the big pop hits are and how little bearing they have on necessarily the sound of a generation. I think part of what's interesting about American Idol is it's probably the closest thing we have to the one sort of mainstream pop culture monolith that the most people pay attention to. And it, you know, crosses generations, but it's very much seen as sort of an engine of youth culture. And if you watch American Idol, one of the things that's fascinating about it is that it's practically every week is like 60s night, you know, show tunes, you know, Neil Sedaka, Peter Noon. And so, you know, I mean, they had Neil Diamond night this season. And so while that should be one of the monolithic things that drives the sound of this generation, it often isn't, with this one exception that I would like to play, which is...
You cut Stephen's mic off, please.
Which is, I would like to launch a spirited defense. I'm certainly not the first person to launch a spirited defense of Kelly Clarkson, who was the first American Idol winner, and who has sort of one of the few people who's, I think, managed to transcend the kind of karaoke quality of American Idol and actually make an interesting record.
Have you heard any of Fantasia's stuff?
Oh, that's true. You know, I liked Fantasia as well. But, you know, Fantasia, to me, at the time especially, sounded a lot like Macy Gray and didn't strike me as enormously exciting. Would you disagree with that?
I think she does share as much with Macy Gray as, you know, Kelly Clarkson shares with Avril Lavigne or Pink.
Well, I guess the point I'm making is that Since You've Been Gone is awesome.
Oh, no denying that. I fully agree with you. Okay, I'm just saying that Kelly Clarkson isn't necessarily the only.
Yeah, you're good right. You're right. That was a grossly unfair generalization.
you can sit down now, Stephen. Okay. Sit down.
Okay. I'm feeling better.
Let's hear it.
Yeah, let's play Since You've Been Gone.
Here's the thing. We started out friends. It was cool, but it was all pretend. Yeah, yeah. Since you've been gone.
It's my contention that you could put this song and the Nirvana song together and they will
you could do a
explode
mashup
at the same moment in the same way.
Well, I think it's I think it is a song of this generation that does take your feelings and blow them up into a giant anthem that's cathartic.
Mm-hmm. This fellow Ian, and this add to the All Songs Considered blog, but he wrote, so this generation's music is built on the music of the past rather than radical departure. Think of it like the romantic period of music, taking forms and themes of the classical and baroque periods, works, and making them more complex and robust, keeping what worked and discarding what didn't. I thought that was pretty good. And there's a whole bunch of great writing.
I think that could be said for any generation.
Oh, no, that's not true. The best thing the 60s did, whether you like the music or not, is it threw everything away. The best thing that most of punk music did was it threw everything away. You don't hear in music from, you don't hear Jimi Hendrix in any other music ever, you know, and you don't hear in what so many bands did in the 1960s and early 70s, what came before it. That's what was wonderful about that music. It tossed off their parents' music. And somebody else wrote, this is the first generation that not only listens to their parents' music, but listens to their grandparents' music.
I would disagree with that. You know, the 60s, the Rolling Stones, you know, that took from early rock and roll. It took from the blues.
It did until 1966. That's where it all shifted. And you can't listen to Beggar's Banquet and hear Sympathy for the Devil and think of blues because it was really different. Sympathy for the Devil is not a blues song. There was no song like it.
Well, I do think, though.
But I hear you.
I think part of Amy's point, I'm kind of siding with Amy on this, is that everything is going to be a reaction to what came before it. Even if it's just a complete rebellion, even if it's a total rejection, there's still a sense that it's going to be somewhat informed by what came before.
Okay, so this generation then.
It's doing the same thing, I think, you know, except in, you know, maybe less explosive terms because you can't be as explosive as you were due to the nature of technology, maybe.
Boy.
I think we can all agree that this generation is cranking out just an unbelievable amount of amazing music, and it's one of the reasons we're here.
True, true. But, going back to what the guy was saying is, you know, we don't see some kind of new genre being invented really yet.
Certainly not a dominant genre. Yeah.
Right, not a dominant genre, mm-hmm. like grunge or hip-hop or rock and roll.
Do you think we just plain won't anymore?
I think it'll be pretty hard, uh-huh. but I mean, I'd love to, you know. I hope, but I'm skeptical.
Great. Thank you all. Amy Phillips, she's in Chicago. She writes for Pitchfork. Carrie Brownstein's in Portland, and she writes for NPR Music, a blog called Monitor Mix. Stephen Thompson edits Song of the Day every day, a new song, and good choices, and writers that write about them, and we do here, All Songs Considered, and we try to find what that new music will be. There's a song that I was listening to, came up randomly on my iPod this morning, so maybe I'd like to go out on it. It's an Acherville River song, and I only play it not so much in what its music says as music, but what its references and lyrics references so many musical bits and pieces of lyrics of the past. And I gotta remember the name of the song. It's called Plus One. So let's listen to that. Thank you, everybody. And write, if you hear the show, write on the All Songs Considered blog. Add to this. I know we left so much out. There's so much to be said, but we want to hear your voice. And so go there. Go to npr.org/allsongs and look for the little thing. It's a little record label thing. It says blog. Click it and just start writing. The Sound of a Generation, I think, is the name of the blog post. I'm Bob Boylan for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.
No one wants to hear about your 97th tear, so dry your eyes or let it go uncried, my dear. I am all out of love to mouth and to your ear, and not above letting a love song disappear before it's written. And no one wants a tune about the 100th left balloon that was seen shooting from the window of your room, to be a spot against the sky's colossal gloom, and land deflated in some neighbor's state that's strewn with 99 others. 8 Chinese brothers. Well, there's a reason why the last is smiling wider, sitting higher than the others, swinging his arms. You would probably die before you shot up 9 miles high, your eyes dilated as light played upon the side of TVC 16 as it sings you good night. Relaxed as hell and locked up in 45, well, I hope you're feeling better. The 51st way to leave your lover. Admittedly, it doesn't seem to be as gentle or as clean as all the others. Leave the scars all in the after hours of some Green Point bar. I can't listen, baby, about the fourth time you were a lady and how your forthrightness betrayed a secret shyness, stripped away by days of being hailed as your highness. And what's new, pussycat, is you were once a lioness. They cut your claws out. Yet not everyone's keen on lighting candle 17. The party's done, the cake's all gone, the plates are clean. The chauffeur's leering from the cheerless mezzanine. And in just 1 year, the straight world can pay to see what they have been missing. But you were caught kissing 8 Chinese brothers. Well, there's a reason why the last smiling wide and sitting higher than the others. Says, let's get lost, let them send out alarms. He says, let's get crossed out and come to harm. Let's make the world's stupidest stand and truly mean it. Let's hit the limit of laws over lovers' arms. No, let's exceed it.